academically minded, but Gwen has had it in for him ever since Candy Machine Gate. Oh, Su Lin, just writing this transports me to the halcyon days when we were happily collecting outrages about Bernadette. What simple times those were. From Su Lin Lee Siegel to Audrey Griffin. You want to be transported back? Well, Audrey, buckle your seatbelt. I just had the most devastating conversation with LG Branch, and you'll be shocked to learn what I just did. I put LG in a conf room for an 11 a.m. all hands. I was running around, fulfilling laptop requests, expediting furniture exchanges, authorizing battery orders. I even found a missing ball for the foosball game. All I can say about life at Mr. Softy is, when it rains, it pours. When I got to my office, did I mention I finally have a window office? No less than 6 co-workers told me LG had come by looking for me in person. He'd written a note on my door for everyone to see asking if we could have lunch. He signed it EB, but some joker had come by and changed it to E-Dog, one of his many nicknames. As I headed out, he appeared at my door wearing shoes. I thought we could bicycle, he said. It was such a nice day, we decided to get some sandwiches at the deli downstairs and bike to a nice spot off campus. Because I'm new to Samantha, too, I didn't realize we have a dedicated fleet of bicycles. LG is quite an acrobat. He put one foot on the pedal and skated along with the other, then swung it over the seat. I haven't been on a bike in years, and I'm afraid it showed.
Is something wrong? LG said when I veered off the path and onto the lawn.
I think the handlebars are loose. It was the damnedest thing. I couldn't keep the bike pointing straight. As I got back on, LG stood on his bike with both feet on the pedals and jiggled so he didn't fall over. You think that's easy? Try it sometime. I finally got the hang of it, and we zoomed along. I'd forgotten the freedom that comes with riding a bicycle. The wind was fresh against my face, the sun was shining, and the trees were still dripping from the storm. We rode through the commons, where people were taking their lunch outside, enjoying the sunshine and the Seahawks cheerleaders, who were doing a demonstration on the soccer field. I could feel the curious eyes upon me. Who's that? What's she doing with Elgin Branch? A mile away, LG and I found a church with a lovely fountain courtyard and some benches. We unpacked our sandwiches. The reason I asked you to lunch, he said, is what you said this morning about having my hands full at home. You were referring to Bernadette, weren't you? Oh, I was shocked. Work is work. It was very disorienting for me to switch gears.
I'm wondering if you've noticed anything different about her recently.
LG's eyes welled up with tears. What's wrong? I took his hand, which I know probably sounds forward, but I did it out of compassion. He looked down, then gently extracted his hand. It was fine, really.
If something's wrong, he said, it's my fault as much as it is hers. It's not like I'm around. I'm always working. I mean, she's a great mother.
I didn't like the way LG was talking. Thanks to Victims Against Victimhood, I have grown expert at detecting the signs of being victimized by emotional abuse. Confusion, withdrawal, negotiating reality, self-reproach. At VAV, we don't help newcomers. We crush them. C. Confirm their reality. R. Reveal our own abuse. U. Unite them with VAV. S. Say sayonara to abuse. H. Have a nice life. I launched into the saga of Barry's failed businesses, his trips to Vegas, his intermittent explosive disorder, which was never diagnosed, but which I'm convinced he suffers from, and finally, how I found the strength to divorce him, but not before he successfully drained our life savings.
About Bernadette, he said.
My face flushed. I had been talking a lot about myself and VAV, which I have been known to do. I'm sorry, I said. How can I help?
When you see her at school, how does she seem? Have you noticed anything?
Well, to be honest, I said carefully,
From the beginning, Bernadette didn't seem to value community.
What does that have to do with anything?
The underlying principle of Gaylor Street is community. It's not written anywhere that the parents have to participate, but the school is built on unspoken assumptions. For instance, I am in charge of classroom volunteers. Bernadette has never once signed up. Another thing, she never walks B into the classroom.
That's because you drive up and drop off the kids, LG said.
You can do that, but most mothers prefer to walk their children into the classroom, especially if you're a stay-at-home mom.
I guess I'm not understanding, he said.
The foundation of Gaylor Street is parent participation, I pointed out.
But we write a check each year on top of tuition. Isn't that participation enough?
There's financial participation, and there's the other, more meaningful participation, like traffic duty, baking healthy snacks for talent night, brushing hair on picture day.
I'm sorry, he said, but I'm with Bernadette on this.
All I'm trying to do, I felt my voice rising and took a breath. I'm trying to give you a context for the tragedy this weekend.
What tragedy? He said. Audrey, I thought he was joking.
Haven't you been getting the emails?
What emails? LG asked.
From Gaylor Street.
God, no, he said. I asked to be taken off those lists years ago. Hang on. What are you talking about?
I proceeded to tell him about Bernadette erecting that billboard and destroying your home.
Hand to God!
He, nothing. He just sat there, taking it all in. At one point, he dropped his sandwich and didn't even bother to pick it up. My phone alarm beeped. It was 2:15, and he had a 2:30 skip 1:1. We bicycled back. The sky was black except for a brilliant white cloud patch where rays of sunshine broke through. We rode in a darling neighborhood of little bungalows cuddled together. I love the gray-green putty colors against the leafless cherry trees and Japanese maples. I could feel the crocus, daffodil, and tulip bulbs underground gaining strength, patiently enduring our winter, waiting to burst forth for another glorious Seattle spring. I held my hand out and whooshed it through the thick, healthy air. What other city has given birth to the jumbo jet, the internet superstore, the personal computer, the cellular phone, online travel, grunge music, the big box store, good coffee? Where else could somebody like me ride bikes alongside the man with the fourth most watched TED Talk? I started laughing.
What's wrong? LG asked.
Oh, nothing.
I was remembering how crushed I was when my father couldn't afford to send me to USC, and instead I went to the UW. I'd hardly been out of Washington State, and I still have never seen New York City. Suddenly, I didn't care. Let everyone else travel all over the world. What they're searching for in Los Angeles and New York and everywhere else is something I already have right here in Seattle. I want it all to myself. From Audrey Griffin. 2. Sulin Lee Siegel.
Do you think I woke up this morning and drank a big cup of stupid? Wouldn't it be convenient if Elgin Branch knew nothing of his wife's swath of destruction? I shared your tale with Warren, who suspected the same thing as me. Elgin Branch is attempting to establish a paper trail so when we sue him for everything he's worth, he can claim ignorance. Well, that trick won't work. Why don't you tell that to E-Dog next time you're littering at a house of God? He didn't receive any of the emails. What a pantload!
From Audrey Griffin. 2. Gwen Goodyear.
Gwen, please check the all-school email list and confirm that Elgin Branch is on it. I'm not talking about Bernadette, but Elgin Branch specifically.
Audrey.
It was Kennedy's birthday that night and her mother works night, so Mom and I did what we always do, which is take Kennedy out for a birthday dinner. That morning at drop-off, Kennedy was waiting for me and Mom to pull up. Where are we going? Where are we going? Kennedy said.
Mom rolled down her window.
the Space Needle restaurant.
Kennedy screamed with joy and started jumping up and down. First Daniel's broiler and now this? Mom, I said, since when did you get so super cool about restaurants?
Since now.
On the way to homeroom, Kennedy had a hard time containing her excitement. Nobody ever goes to the Space Needle restaurant, she shrieked, which is true because even though it's at the top and it revolves, which should make it the only restaurant you'd ever go to, it's totally touristy and the food is expensive. Then Kennedy did her growl thing and tackled me. It had been at least 10 years since I'd been to the Space Needle restaurant, and I'd forgotten how awesome it is. We ordered, then Mom reached into her purse and whipped out a pencil and piece of white cardboard. In the middle, she'd written in different colored markers, "My name is Kennedy, and I'm turning fabulous 15. "Huh?" Kennedy said. "You've never been here, have you?" Mom asked Kennedy, then turned to me. "And you don't remember, do you?" I shook my head. "We put this on the windowsill." She propped the card against the glass, and we put a pencil next to it. "While the restaurant revolves, everyone will write something, so when it comes back around, you'll have a card full of birthday wishes." "That's so cool," Kennedy said, at the same time that I said, "That's no fair."
"We can come here for your birthday next year, I promise," Mom said.
The birthday card slowly left us, and oh, we had so much fun. We did the one thing that Kennedy and I always do when we're with Mom, which is talk about youth group. Mom was raised Catholic and became an atheist in college, so she completely freaked out when I started going to youth group. But I only went because it was Kennedy's idea. Kennedy's mom spends half her life at Costco, so they have these huge bags of candy bars and drums of licorice at home. Plus, they have a giant TV with every cable channel, which means I spent a lot of time at Kennedy's house eating candy and watching Friends. But then one day, Kennedy started thinking she was fat and wanted to go on a diet. And she was like, "B, you can't eat licorice because I don't want to get fat." Kennedy is totally crazy like that. And we always have the craziest conversations. So she made this huge declaration that we weren't allowed to go to her house anymore because it makes her fat. And instead, we had to go to youth group. She called it her youth group diet. I kept it secret from Mom as long as I could, but when she found out, she was furious because she thought I was going to turn into a Jesus freak. But Luke and his wife May, who run youth group, aren't into that at all. Well, okay, they're a little into that, but their Bible talk lasts only like 15 minutes, and when they're done, we have 2 hours to watch TV and play games. I kind of feel sorry for Luke and May because they're all excited to have half of Gaylord Street coming over on Fridays, but they have no idea there's nowhere else to go because Friday is the one day there's no sports or extracurriculars, and all we really want to do is watch TV. Still, Mom hates youth group, which Kennedy thinks is the most hilarious thing in the world. "Hey, Bee's Mom," Kennedy said. That's what she calls Mom. "Have you ever heard of poop in the stew?"
"Poop in the stew?" Mom said.
"We learned about it in youth group," Kennedy said. "Luke and May did a puppet show about drugs, and the donkey was like, 'Well, just one little puff of marijuana can't hurt.' But the lamb said, 'Life is stew, and pot is poop. If someone stirred even a teeny tiny bit of poop in the stew, would you really want to eat it?"
"And those featherheads wonder why people are fleeing the church? Puppet shows for teenagers?"
Before Mom could totally go off, I grabbed Kennedy's hand. "Let's go to the bathroom again," I said. The bathroom is in the part of the restaurant that doesn't revolve, so when you return, your table isn't where you left it. That time, we were walking back all like, "Where did our table go?" And we finally spotted Mom. Dad was there, too. He was wearing jeans, hiking boots, and a parka. And he still had his Microsoft badge around his neck. Some things you just know. And I just knew Dad had found out about the mudslide. "Your dad's here," Kennedy said. "I can't believe he came to my birthday party. That's so nice."
I tried to stop Kennedy, but she squirmed away and bolted over. "Those blackberries were the only thing holding up the hillside," Dad was saying.
You knew that, Bernadette. Why on earth would you denude an entire hillside in the middle of the wettest winter on record?
How did you find out? Mom said.
Oh, let me guess. Your admin is pouring poison in your ears.
Keep Sue Lynn out of this, Dad said. She's the only reason it's even feasible for me to leave for 3 weeks.
If you're interested in the truth, Mom said, I had the blackberries removed in accordance with the specifications of Bugs Meany.
Bugs Meany from Encyclopedia Brown? Kennedy said. That's so awesome!
Will you stop treating this as a joke? Dad told Mom. I look at you, Bernadette, and I'm scared. You won't talk to me. You won't go to a doctor. You're better than this.
Dad, I said, stop freaking out.
Yeah, really, Kennedy said. Happy birthday to me.
There was a moment of quiet. Then me and Kennedy burst into giggles. I'm like, happy birthday to me, Kennedy said, which triggered another fit of laughter.
The Griffin's house caved in, Dad said to Mom. They're living at a hotel. Is this something we're going to have to pay for?
Mudslides are considered an act of God, so the Griffin's insurance covers it.
It was like Dad was a crazy person who had come into the Space Needle waving a loaded gun, and then he turned it on me.
Why didn't you tell me, B?
I don't know, I said quietly.
Goody goody gumdrops, Kennedy said. Here comes my birthday card.
She grabbed my arm really hard and squeezed it.
Could you please take some Ritalin and shut up, I said.
B, Dad snapped. What did you just say? You don't talk to people like that.
It's okay, Mom told Dad. It's how they talk to each other.
No, it's not. He turned to Kennedy. Kennedy, I need to apologize for my daughter.
For what?
She asked.
Here comes my card.
Dad, I said, why do you even care? You don't even like Kennedy.
He doesn't? Kennedy said.
Of course I like you, Kennedy. B, how could you say such a thing? What's going on with this family? I just came here to have a conversation.
You came here to yell at Mom, I said.
Audrey Griffin yelled at her already. You weren't even there. It was horrible.
Get it! Get it! Kennedy climbed over me and grabbed her birthday card.
It's not about yelling at Mom, Dad became flustered. This is a conversation between me and your mother. It was my mistake to interrupt Kennedy's birthday dinner. I didn't know when I'd have the time otherwise.
Because you're always working, I mumbled.
What's that?
Dad demanded.
Nothing.
I'm working for you and for Mom. And because the work I'm doing has the potential to help millions of people. I'm working especially long hours now so I can take you to Antarctica.
Oh, no, Kennedy shrieked. I hate this thing.
She was about to rip up her card, but I grabbed it out of her hand. It was full of patches of different writing. There were a few happy birthdays, but mostly the card was covered with things like, Jesus is our Savior, remember our Lord Jesus died for our sins, plus passages from the Bible. I started laughing, and then Kennedy started crying, which she does sometimes. Really, the thing to do is just let it pass. Mom snatched the card. Don't worry, Kennedy, she said. I'm going to go hunt down those Jesus freaks.
No, you're not,
Dad said to Mom.
Do it, Kennedy said, suddenly perky. I want to watch.
Yeah, Mom, I want to watch too.
I'm leaving, Dad said. Nobody cares. Nobody listens. Nobody wants me here. Happy birthday, Kennedy. Goodbye, B. Bernadette, go ahead. Embarrass yourself. Attack people who have actually found some meaning in their lives. We'll continue this when you get home.
When we drove up to the house, the light in their bedroom was on. Mom headed straight out to the Petit Trianon. I went inside. The floorboards above me creaked. It was Dad getting out of bed, walking to the top of the stairs.
Girls, he called down. Is that you?
I held my breath. A whole minute passed. Dad walked back to the bedroom, then to the bathroom. The toilet flushed. I grabbed ice cream by her flabby neck, and we slept with Mom out in the Petit Trianon. And Mom didn't hunt down the Jesus freaks at the restaurant. But she did write,
It's a child's birthday! What the hell is wrong with you people?
And set it on the window. And as we left, it started to go around.
Thursday, December 16th. From Gwen Goodyear to Audrey Griffin.
Good morning, Audrey. I checked with Kate Webb, and she does remember Bernadette and Elgin Branch requesting to be opted out of all Gaylor Street emails back when B first enrolled. I double-checked myself, and indeed, they are not on any of the lists we currently employ. On another topic, I'm glad to see you're settled and that your internet connection is working. Per my last 3 unanswered emails, Mr. Levy feels it's imperative that we sit down and have a talk about Kyle. I can work around your schedule. Kindly, Gwen.
That morning in homeroom, we were doing vocabulary lightning round, where Mr. Levy throws out a word and points to someone, and they have to use that word in a sentence. Mr. Levy said, sheathe, and pointed at Kyle. And Kyle said, sheathe my dick. We have never laughed so hard. That is so why Mr. Levy wanted to have a conference with Audrey Griffin. Because even though it's totally funny, I can also see why it's kind of bad.
From Sue Lynn Lee Siegel to Audrey Griffin. I have chosen to disregard the tone of your previous nasty gram and chalk it up to the stress of your living conditions. Audrey, you have LG all wrong. This morning, I got on the connector at my usual stop and settled into a seat in the back. LG boarded a few stops later, looking like he hadn't slept. He lit up when he saw me. I think he'd forgotten I'd signed us up for the same connector. Did you know he's from a prominent family in Philadelphia? Not that he would come out and say such a thing, but as a boy, he spent all his summers in Europe. I was embarrassed to admit that I'd never left the United States.
We'll have to change that, won't we? He said.
Don't jump to any conclusions, Audrey. He said that rhetorically. It's not like he's planning on taking me on a trip to Europe or anything. He went to boarding school. On that topic, it seems you and I were simply misinformed. People like me and you, who were born in Seattle and went to the UW, we lack the... I don't want to use the word sophistication, but we lack the something to understand this broader world view.
When LG asked about me, I was flustered because I've led such a dull life. The only thing I could think of that is remotely interesting is how my father went blind when I was 7 and that I had to take care of him.
No kidding, LG said. So you communicated in sign language?
Only when I was feeling cruel, I retorted.
LG was confused.
He was blind, I said. Not deaf. We both broke up laughing. Someone quipped, what is this, the Belltown Connector?
It's an inside joke. The Belltown Connector is notoriously raucous, much more so than the Queen Anne Connector. So it was a combination of get a room and a reference to what fun they have on the Belltown Connector. I'm not sure my explanation helps you get the humor. Maybe you had to be there.
We turned to the subject of work. LG was anxious about the amount of time he was taking off for Christmas.
You keep calling it a month, I said. It's 27 days, 12 of which are Christmas vacation when Microsoft clears out anyway. 6 days are weekends. You have 5 travel days where you'll be in hotels with internet access, I checked. That leaves you out of touch for a total of 9. That's like having a bad flu.
Wow, he said. I can actually breathe.
Your only mistake was telling the team you were leaving in the first place. I could have covered for you and nobody would have known.
I told them before you came along, he said.
Then you're forgiven. Most wonderful was that by the time we arrived, LG's spirits were buoyed, which made me happy too.
From Ms. Goodyear, hand-delivered to the Weston.
Audrey and Warren. A disturbing allegation has been presented to me regarding Kyle. A parent came to me a month ago with an accusation that Kyle had been selling drugs to students in the hallways. I refused to believe it, for your sake as much as Kyle's. Yesterday, however, another parent found 20 pills in her child's backpack. These pills have been identified as OxyContin. Under questioning, the student pointed to Kyle as the source. The student has been allowed to continue classes for the next week,
With the understanding he, she will receive treatment over winter break. I need to speak to you and Warren immediately. Kindly, Gwen Goodyear.
From Audrey Griffin to Gwen Goodyear.
You're going to have to do better than that if you wish to implicate Kyle in a Gaylor Street drug ring.
Warren is curious about how a legal prescription for Vicodin, written to me, which I asked Kyle to carry because I was on crutches due to an injury sustained on your campus, something I never considered holding Gaylor Street liable for, even though the statute of limitations gives me plenty of time to change my mind, has anything to do with 20 OxyContin? Was my name on those pills, too? Speaking of Warren, he's looking into the legality of letting a student who's a known drug abuser finish out the semester. Isn't that a threat to the other students? I'm asking out of curiosity. If you're so hell-bent on placing blame, I suggest you look in the mirror.
From Audrey Griffin to Sue Lynn Lee Siegel.
Excuse me for not responding sooner, but it has taken me an hour to pull my jaw off the floor. I'm spending Christmas in a hotel, and you're lauding my tormentor? Last time I checked my calendar, it was the middle of December, not April 1st.
From Sue Lynn Lee Siegel to Audrey Griffin.
Let me clarify. Elgin Branch walking down the aisle of the Microsoft Connector is like Diana Ross walking through her adoring audience that time we saw her in Las Vegas. People literally reach out and touch him. I'm not sure LG knows any of them, but he's led so many gigantic meetings and been on so many teams that his face is familiar to hundreds, if not thousands, of MS employees. Last year, when he won Outstanding Technical Leadership, which is awarded to the 10 greatest visionaries in a company of 100,000, they hung a huge banner of his face from Building 33. He raised more money than anyone to be dunked in the dunk tank for the company-wide giving campaign, not to mention his TED Talk, which is number 4 on the list of all-time most-watched TED Talks. No wonder he wears sound-canceling headphones. Otherwise, people would be climbing over one another to get some FaceTime with him. Frankly, it stuns me that he takes the connector to work at all. My point is, it would have been wholly unprofessional for us to launch into Bernadette's transgressions with everyone straining to listen in.
From Audrey Griffin to Sue Lynn Lee Siegel.
I don't give a fig about Ted. I don't know who he is, and I don't care what he says during this talk you refuse to shut up about.
From Sue Lynn Lee Siegel to Audrey Griffin.
Audrey, TED stands for Technology, Entertainment, and Design. The TED Conference is an exclusive meeting of the most brilliant minds in the world. It's held once a year in Long Beach, and it's an enormous privilege to be chosen to give a talk. Here's a link to LG's TED Talk. Sue Lynn. Dad's TED Talk was a really big deal. All the kids at school knew about it. Ms. Goodyear had Dad come to give the whole school a live demonstration. It's hard to believe Audrey Griffin had never heard of it.
Live blog transcript of Dad's TED Talk posted by the blogger Masked Enzyme. 4:30 p.m. afternoon break. Half hour to go until session 10. Code and mind. The last one of the day. The gals at the Vosges chocolate booth really outdid themselves for this break, passing out truffles with bacon. Hot buzz at the end of session 9, while Mark Zuckerberg droned on about some education initiative that nobody gave a shit about, the Vosges girls started frying their bacon, and the smell wafted into the auditorium. This got everyone murmuring excitedly, "Do you smell bacon? I smell bacon." Chris bolted out and must have torn into the Vosges girls, who now have mascara dripping down their cheeks. Chris has always had his detractors, and this sure didn't help. 4:45 p.m., people filing into the auditorium for Session 10. Ben Affleck having his picture taken with Murray Gell-Mann. Dr. Gell-Mann arrived this morning, driving up to the valet in his Lexus with New Mexico plates reading Quark. Nice touch, nice man. While we were on break, the stage was transformed into a living room, or maybe a college dorm. Lazy boy recliner, TV set, microwave, vacuum, a robot too. Jesus Christ, there's a robot on stage. It's a cute one. 4 feet high, anthropomorphic, hourglass shape, dare I say, a sexy robot? Program says next speaker is a dancer from Madagascar discussing her creative process. What's the robot for, then? Will there be some kind of African lesbian robot living room dance? Stay tuned. This might get good. Guy with eye patch and Nehru jacket, who gave deranged talk last year about floating cities, just sat down where Al Gore usually sits. No reserved seats at TED, Natch, but Al Gore has sat in the third row, right aisle, dating back to Monterey, and everyone knows it. You don't just go plop down in Al Gore's spot. Jane doing housekeeping announcements. Gift bag pickup closes tonight. Last chance to test drive Tesla. Luncheon tomorrow with the awesome E.O. Wilson for an update on his TED wish, the Encyclopedia of Life. Al Gore just entered, talking with Sergey Brin's parents. They're so cute and tiny and don't speak great English. All eyes on the Veep, waiting to see how he reacts to the fact that his seat is taken. Nehru jacket offers to move, but Al Gore declines. Nehru hands Al Gore a business card. What a dirty trick. He's practically booed by the audience, but nobody will admit to being that interested. Al Gore takes business card with a smile. I heart Al Gore. 5 p.m., Chris takes the stage. Announces that before the African lady, there will be a surprise talk, a mind-bender, he promises, on brain-computer interface. People snap out of their truffle and bacon haze. Chris introduces Elgin Branch from, wait for it, Microsoft Research. Research is the only half-decent group at MS, but really? Microsoft? Audience deflating, energy dissipating. 5:45 p.m. Holy crap. Disregard snarkiness of 5 p.m. post. Give me a second. I'm going to need some time. 7 p.m. Samantha 2. Thanks for your patience. This talk won't post on the TED website for a month. In the meantime, let me try to do it justice. Big shout out to my blogging pal, TED Girl, for letting me transcribe her phone video. 5 p.m. Branch puts on headset. On the big screen. Elgin Branch. You've got a feel for these guys who have only 5 minutes. They're all rushing and nervous. 5:01 p.m. Branch. 25 years ago, my first job was testing code for a research team at Duke. They were attempting to merge mind and computer. 5:02 p.m. Clicker doesn't work. Branch hits it again, and again. Branch looking around. This isn't working, he says to everyone and no one. 5:03 p.m. Branch bravely soldiering on without video. They set two Reese's monkeys in front of a video screen with joysticks, which controlled a little animated ball. Every time the monkeys used the joysticks to move the ball in a basket, they were rewarded with a treat. He clicks again and again and looks around. Nobody is coming to help. This is ridiculous. The guy's a good sport. David Byrne stormed off stage this morning when his audio blew. 5:05 p.m., Branch. That was supposed to be a video of the pioneering Duke study. In it, you'd see a pair of monkeys with 200 electrodes implanted into their brain's motor cortex. They looked like those grow-her-hair Barbies with the crown of their heads cut open and a bunch of wires cascading down. It's pretty grisly. It's probably best that I can't show you. Anyway, it was an early instance of brain-computer interface, or BCI. He clicks the clicker again. I had a really good slide explaining how it worked. IMHO. The guy should be angrier about this. It's a technology conference, and they can't get the clickers to work. 5:08 p.m., Branch.
After the monkeys had mastered using the joysticks to move the balls, the researchers disconnected the joysticks. The monkeys fiddled with the joysticks for a couple seconds, but recognized they no longer worked. They still wanted their treats, so they sat there staring at the screen and thought about moving the balls into the baskets. At this point, the electrodes implanted into their motor cortexes were activated. They diverted the monkeys' thoughts to a computer, which we had programmed to interpret their brain signals and act on their thoughts. The monkeys realized they could move the ball just by thinking about it, and they received their treats. The most amazing thing when you watch the video, Branch squints into the spotlight. Do we have the video? It would be great to see the video. Anyway, what's remarkable is how quickly the monkeys mastered moving the balls with their thoughts. It took them about 15 seconds. 5:10 p.m. Branch squints into the audience. They tell me I have 1 minute left. 5:10 p.m. Chris jumps on stage and apologizes. He's pissed about the clicker. We all are. This Branch guy is nice and low-key, and he said nothing about the robot. 5:12 p.m., Branch. The job ended. Years later, I found my way to Microsoft in robotic. Crowd cheers. Branch squints. What? He obviously has no idea how excited we've all become about that damn robot. 5:13 p.m., Branch. I went to work on the voice-activated personal robot you see in front of you. A rumble from the audience. Who cares if Craig Venter just announced he'd synthesized arsenic-based life in a test tube? Give us a Jetson-style robot any day. 5:13 p.m. Branch continues. Let's say I'm in the mood for some popcorn. I say, Samantha! The robot lights up. We named her Samantha after the character on Bewitched. Laughter. Samantha, please bring me some popcorn. You have to see this guy, Branch. He's very sweet and unassuming, wearing jeans, t-shirt, and no shoes. He looks like he just rolled out of bed. 5:14 p.m. Samantha glides to the microwave, opens the door, and removes a bag of popcorn. Branch. We had to pre-pop that like one of the cooking shows. The robot rolls to Branch and hands him a bag of popcorn. Applause! Branch. Thank you, Samantha. Robot replies. You're welcome. Laughter. Branch. It's cute, basic, voice-activated technology. 5:17 p.m. A voice from the front row says, Can I have some of that? It's David Pogue. Branch. Okay, ask her. Pogue. Samantha, bring me some popcorn. The robot doesn't move. Branch. Say please. Pogue. Come on. Laughter. Branch. I'm serious. My daughter was 8 when I was working on Samantha, and she accused me of being a bully. So I programmed it in. Please. It's literally the magic word. Pogue. Samantha, bring me some popcorn. Please. Hilarity ensuing. The robot rolls to the edge of the stage and reaches out, but drops the bag of popcorn before Pogue can grab it. It spills all over the stage. 5:19 p.m. Branch. It's Microsoft. We had some bugs. A thunderclap of laughter from the audience. Branch looks offended. It wasn't that funny. 5:21 p.m. Branch. We taught Samantha 500 commands. We could have taught her 500 more, but what kept holding us back was her thousands of moving parts. She lacked marketplace agility and was too expensive to scale up. Eventually, the Samantha project was canceled. Everyone in the audience goes, Aww. Branch, what are you people, a bunch of geeks? Instant TED classic. 5:23 p.m. A guy meanders onto the stage carrying a new clicker. Halfway across, he stops and hitches up his pants. Branch, take your time. Huge laughter. 5:24 p.m., Branch. So Samantha was canceled, but then I remembered those monkeys at Duke, and I thought,
The complicating factor in creating a personal robot is the robot itself. Maybe we could just lose the robot. 5:25 p.m. Branch's clicker finally works, so he starts the slideshow. First image is monkeys with wires coming out of their heads. Audience gasps. Some scream. Branch. Sorry, sorry. Branch turns off slideshow. 5:26 p.m. Branch. According to Moore's law, the number of transistors that can be placed on an integrated surface doubles every 2 years. So in 20 years' time, what once was that horrible image became this. He clicks through to a slide showing a person's shaved head with what looks like a computer chip under the skin. 5:26 p.m. Branch. Which became this. He holds up a football helmet with a Seahawks sticker on it. On the inside are electrodes with wires coming out. You could just put it on and nothing had to be wired into your brain. 5:27 p.m. Branch puts down the helmet and reaches into his pocket. Which became this. He holds up something that looks like a Band-Aid. Tedsters, meet Samantha Too. 5:27 p.m. Branch sticks the Band-Aid on his forehead, just under his hairline. He sits down in the Lazy Boy. Branch. I'm going to throw in some real time for the skeptics. He pulls the lever and the chair reclines. 5:29 p.m. Weird sound. A vacuum has started up. It's moving on its own. Coming over and vacuuming up popcorn. Branch is lying down with his eyes open, concentrating on the popcorn. Vacuum turns off. Branch turns to face the TV. 5:31 p.m. TV turns on by itself. Channels changing. It stops at a Lakers game. 5:31 p.m. Big screen changes to Outlook. A blank email opens. The cursor goes to the To field. It's writing on its own. Bernadette. The cursor jumps to the message field. TED Talk went well. Clicker didn't work. Too bad nobody here knows PowerPoint. David Pogue is kind of uncoordinated. P.S. Lakers leading by 3 at the half. The place is on its feet. What can best be described as a roar is coming from the audience. Branch gets up and pulls the Band-Aid off his forehead and holds it up. 5:32 p.m. Branch. In March, we ship Samantha Too to Walter Reed Hospital. Go to the Microsoft website today and watch a video of paralyzed veterans using Samantha Too to cook for themselves in a smart kitchen. Watch TV, work on a computer, even care for a pet. At Samantha Too, our goal is to help our wounded veterans live independent and productive lives. The possibilities are endless. Thank you. The audience goes ape shit. Chris has taken the stage and is hugging Branch. Nobody can believe what they just saw. Voila! There it is. Samantha Too. From Audrey Griffin to Sue Lynn Lee Siegel. I've had enough of you. Do you understand? Enough! From Dr. Janelle Kurtz. Dear Mr. Branch, I've received your inquiry regarding your wife. Perhaps I've misread your intent, but what you genially refer to as supervised R&R, which you fear Bernadette won't be too keen on, is in practicality asking that she be detained against her will at Madrona Hill. The procedure for such extreme action is detailed in the Involuntary Treatment Act, Title 71, Chapter 5, Section 150 of the Revised Code of Washington. Per the ITA, in order for a county-designated mental health professional to place an individual on an involuntary hold, the CDMHP must thoroughly evaluate the person and determine if they are an imminent danger to themselves, others, or property due to a psychiatric illness. If you believe your wife poses such a threat, you must immediately call 911 and have her taken to an emergency room. There she will be assessed. If it is determined that Bernadette does present such a threat, she will be asked to voluntarily seek appropriate treatment.
If your wife refuses, her civil liberties will be suspended, and she will be transferred to a state-licensed psychiatric hospital and put on an ITA hold for up to 72 hours. From that point, it's up to the courts. Madrona Hill on Orcas Island is unique in that, along with our renowned inpatient and residential treatment, we operate the only private psych ER in the state. Therefore, I witness the devastating effects of involuntary commitment every day. Families are ripped apart. Police, lawyers, and judges get involved. It goes on public record for all future employers and financial institutions to see. Because it is so costly in terms of blood, treasure, and emotion, involuntary commitment should be considered only after every other option has been exhausted. As you describe it, your wife's behavior is cause for concern. I was surprised to learn that she isn't in therapy. That seems like a logical first step. I'd be happy to suggest some wonderful psychiatrists in your area who could meet Bernadette and ask the proper questions so she can receive appropriate treatment. Don't hesitate to call if this is a path you choose to pursue. Sincerely, Dr. Janelle Kurtz.
IM exchange between Dad and Sue Lynn during a staff meeting. Sue Lynn, L.S. Everything okay? You seem distracted.
Elgin B. Starting to question my sanity. Home stuff.
Sue Lynn, L.S. If you were to share your stories about Bernadette at a VAB meeting, you couldn't get through two sentences without getting torched.
Torch stands for time out, reality check.
Sue Lynn, L.S. Any time a speaker slips into the abuser's story, for instance, if I were to say something like, I know I'm always tired and all I want to talk about is work, which is what Barry used to accuse me of, someone stands up and torches them by yelling, time out, reality check.
Sue Lynn, L.S. It teaches us to separate our reality from our abuser's story, which is the first step toward halting the abuse cycle.
Sue Lynn, L.S. I know you'll be uncomfortable with some of the VAV terminology. I was, too. I thought, I'm not being abused by Barry.
Sue Lynn, L.S.
But at VAV, our definition of abuse is intentionally broad and esteem positive. We are victims, make no mistake about it, but we want to move beyond victimhood, which is a subtle yet important distinction.
Sue Lynn, L.S.
LG, you are a level 80 at the most successful company in the world. You've vested out 3 times. You have a daughter who's thriving academically despite several heart surgeries.
Sue Lynn, L.S. Your TED Talk is ranked number 4 on the all-time most watched list, yet you live with a woman who has no friends, destroys homes, and falls asleep in stores.
Sue Lynn, L.S. I'm sorry, LG. You are hereby torched.
Elgin B. Thanks for this, but I kind of have to concentrate. We'll read more carefully after meeting.
Friday, December 17th. From Bernadette Fox. 2. Manjula Kapoor. I'm back! Did you miss me? You know how I said I was going to come up with a way to get out of going to Antarctica? What if I had emergency surgery? My dentist, Dr. Neergard, keeps insisting I get all 4 wisdom teeth removed, which I haven't been in any rush to do. But how about I call up Dr. Neergard and ask him to remove all 4 wisdom teeth the day before the trip?
And when I say how about I call up Dr. Neergard and ask him to remove all 4 wisdom teeth the day before the trip, what I really mean is, how about you call up Dr. Neergard and ask him to remove all 4 wisdom teeth the day before the trip?
I can claim it was an emergency and that I'm devastated, but the doctor forbids me from flying. That way, husband and daughter can go on the trip themselves and nobody blames me.
Dr. Neergard's number is below. Schedule my surgery for December 23rd anytime after 10. There's a school recital that morning and B is doing the choreography. The little rotter has forbidden me from going, but I checked online and found out when it is. My plan is this. I'll go to school, then pretend I'm going Christmas shopping. The next time anyone sees me, I'll look like a chipmunk. I'll claim my teeth had been aching and I pop by Dr. Neergard's.
The next thing I knew, he had removed 4 wisdom teeth, and now I can't go to Antarctica. Here in America, we call that a win-win.
Monday, December 20th, from Marcus Strang of the FBI.
Dear Mr. Branch, I am the regional director of the Internet Crime Complaint Center, IC3, working in partnership with the Department of Homeland Security. My department within the IC3 tracks advance fee schemes and identity fraud. You have come to our attention because of a charge on a Visa card billed to you dated 10/13 in the amount of $40 to a company calling itself Delhi Virtual Assistance International. This company does not exist. It is a shell company for a crime syndicate working out of Russia. We have spent the last 6 months building a case against them. A month ago, we were granted a warrant which allowed us to track emails between your wife, Bernadette Fox, and one Manjula. In the course of this correspondence, your wife has turned over credit card information, bank wiring instructions, social security numbers, driver's license numbers, addresses, passport numbers, and photographs of you, herself, and your daughter. You are apparently unaware of this activity. Your wife suggests in one email to Manjula that you had forbidden her from using the services of Delhi Virtual Assistance International. This matter is delicate and urgent. Yesterday, Manjula asked for power of attorney while your family is away in Antarctica. We were able to intercept this email before it was delivered to your wife. Judging from her past behavior, we had every reason to believe she would sign it without hesitation. As you read this letter, I will be landing in Seattle. I will be at the Microsoft Visitor Center at noon, where I expect you to meet me and offer your full cooperation. In the next 3 hours, it is imperative that you do not share this information with anyone, especially your wife, who has proven herself to be an unreliable actor. The warrant obtained was for all your wife's emails in the past 3 months containing the word Manjula. There were literally hundreds. I have selected the 20 most relevant and have also included a lengthy one from her to a Paul Jelinek. Please familiarize yourself with them prior to my arrival. I suggest you clear your calendar for the rest of the day and week. I look forward to meeting you at the visitor center. With your full cooperation, we are hoping to keep Microsoft out of it. Yours, Marcus Strang. P.S. We all love your TED Talk. I'd love to see the latest on Samantha 2, if time permits.
Part 4. Invaders. Monday, December 20th. Police report filed by night manager at the Westin Hotel. State of Washington, Circuit Court, King County. State of Washington versus Audrey Faith Griffin.
I, Phil Bradstock, an officer with the Seattle Police Department, having been first duly sworn in on oath, state that the above-named defendant on December 20th in the city of Seattle, Washington, while in a public place, did engage in indecent, abusive, boisterous, or otherwise disorderly conduct under circumstances in which such conduct tended to cause or provoke a disturbance contrary to RCW 9A.84.030C2, and did commit assault in the fourth degree as defined in RCW 9A.36.041, both misdemeanors, and upon conviction may be fined not more than $1,000 or imprisoned not more than 30 days or both. This information is based upon the testimony of the complainant Stephen Koenig, night manager at the Westin Hotel in downtown Seattle. I find the testimony of Stephen Koenig to be both truthful and reliable.
1. On Monday, December 20th, at approximately 2 a.m., Stephen Koenig reports that he was on duty as the night manager of the Seattle Westin Hotel when he received a call from guest Audrey Griffin in room 1601, complaining of noise emanating from room 1602. 2. Mr. Koenig reports that he checked the registration list and found room 1602 to be unoccupied. 3.
Mr. Koenig reports that when he conveyed the above information to Ms. Griffin, she became irate and demanded that he investigate in person. 4. Mr. Koenig reports that upon exiting the elevator on the 16th floor, he heard loud voices, laughter, rap music, and what he described as partying. 5. Mr. Koenig reports that he detected traces of smoke and an uncharacteristic odor in the hallway, which in his opinion was weed. 6. Mr. Koenig reports that he tracked the noise and smell to room 1605. 7. Mr. Koenig reports that he knocked on the door and identified himself, at which time the music was turned off and all noise ceased. The momentary silence was followed by giggling. 8. Mr. Koenig reports that Ms. Griffin, wearing a hotel robe, approached him in the hallway and strongly suggested he was knocking on the wrong door, as room 1605 belonged to her son, Kyle, who was asleep. 9. Mr. Koenig reports that after he explained to Ms. Griffin that room 1605 was the source of the noise, she then expressed her low opinion of him using words such as idiot, moron, and incompetent dummy. 10. Mr. Koenig reports that he advised Ms. Griffin of Weston policy regarding verbal abuse. Ms. Griffin then expressed her low opinion of the Weston facility with terms such as dump, flea bag, and pig hole. 11. Mr. Koenig reports that while Ms. Griffin's negative assessment continued, her husband, Warren Griffin, appeared in the hallway squinting and wearing boxer shorts. 12. Mr. Koenig reports that Mr. Griffin's attempt to quiet his wife were met with resistance and verbal abuse. 13. Mr. Koenig reports that while in the process of trying to quiet both husband and wife, Mr. Griffin belched, emitting a nasty stench. 14. Mr. Koenig reports that Ms. Griffin got in her husband's face regarding his abuse of alcohol and insatiable appetite for steak. 15. Mr. Koenig reports that Mr. Griffin went back inside room 1601 and slammed the door. 16. Mr. Koenig reports that while Ms. Griffin was engaged in stating her extreme displeasure with the person who invented alcohol to the closed door of 1601, he stuck his master key in the lock of 1605. 17. Mr. Koenig reports that, out of nowhere, my head jerked back because that crazy bitch, Ms. Griffin, had grabbed hold of his hair and yanked, causing him distress and pain. 18. Mr. Koenig reports that he radioed for Seattle PD, and while he was on the radio, Ms. Griffin entered room 1605 and emitted a scream. 19. Mr. Koenig reports that he entered room 1605 and counted 9 individuals, Ms. Griffin's son, Kyle Griffin, an assorted Seattle street youth. 20. Mr. Koenig reports that he observed a variety of drug paraphernalia, including, but not limited to, bongs, bindles, rolling papers, prescription drug bottles, roach clips, one-hitters, pinchies, rigs, works, spoons, and an epic vape. A visual scan of the room indicated no controlled substances other than shaken seeds on the mini-fridge. 21. Mr. Koenig reports that Ms. Griffin commenced approximately 5 minutes of hysterically expressing disappointment at her son's choice of friends. 22. Mr. Koenig reports that the subdued response on the part of Kyle Griffin and his companions indicated that they were totally wasted. 23. Mr. Koenig reports that Ms. Griffin suddenly lunged at a girl with a teddy bear safety pin to the back of her jacket. Narrative continuation by officer. Upon arrival, I identified myself as Seattle PD. I attempted to pull Ms. Griffin off the teddy bear, which appeared to be causing her acute distress. I informed Ms. Griffin that if she did not lower her voice and step into the hallway with me, I would have to put her in handcuffs. Ms. Griffin started screaming at me with profanity. I am a model citizen. These druggies are the ones breaking the law and corrupting my son. I grabbed hold of her left arm. Ms. Griffin screamed profanities at me while I placed her in handcuffs. Ms. Griffin attempted to pull away, saying, "Take your damn hands off me. You can't touch me. I didn't do anything wrong." She threatened that her husband was a DA and she would use the hotel's video surveillance to prove I was holding her in custody without probable cause and she would make sure the video was all over the evening news. I explained that she was only being temporarily detained while I attempted to ascertain what was going on. Two backup security officers arrived and, with the assistance of my partner, Officer Stanton, escorted the non-hotel residents off the premises.